Shavuot Tov. Welcome to this year's Jewish History class. It's the start of the class for the year 5778. Rabbi Fried gives a great class. Now I believe we're up to the start of the 1500s. And I have to explain that Harvey is not here. He is in Israel doing a very big mitzvah there, so he couldn't make it here. But he will be back, and he will be taking care of it on a regular basis. I'm just temporary. And with that said, we want to thank Rabbi Fried for the years that he gave this year, and we look forward to many more years and learning a lot more from him.
Thank you. I picked up the flyer for the first time, you know, like this past week. I saw it, he sends it to me online, so you take a quick look at it, but like I picked up the flyer and it said the start of the seventh year. I'm saying, my gosh, this is like year seven. You know, when he first asked me, so we start in the beginning of the Beis HaMikdash, the second Beis HaMikdash. I figured I wanted to start post-biblical. I mean, so we catch the end of, and like we just kept going and going. And here I am finding myself up to about the 1500s. If I had to say something about the 1500s, I would probably say, just, you know, very loosely, we were talking about like loose connections. You could say in a certain sense the 1500s is very, very much similar to our time now. In our time now, actually, if you would have, when they did the Jewish demographics, so if you like said where were the Jews living in, let's say, 1933 or 1930, so 20 years later, 30 years later, 90% of the Jews were no longer living in the country that they were 30 years earlier. It was such a tremendous upheaval because of World War II, because of the Holocaust. So then the whole world was just turned over on its side. And that's where we are today, you know, where everything used to be in Europe, and now everything is the main two places, the United States and Israel, and Jews all over the world as well. This is really what was in the 1500s, because there was such tremendous upheaval at the end of the 15th century, at the end of the 1400s, and now the 1500s, the Jews will find themselves in new countries, in new areas, and basically everything is going to be moving east. The Jewish world is mainly split into two main groups, almost like today. Here, I guess today if I say American Jews and Israeli Jews. In those days, it was Sephardic Jews. I mean, when you say Sephardic, it was real Sephardic. I mean, like, really from Spain, like Spanish Jews. Today, the Spanish Jews are really from Spain, but they've been all over since. They just retained what they had from Spain. We'll talk about this, Mitzvah Shem, over the year. And Ashkenazic Jewry, which is European Jewry, which... So here we are today. We find ourselves here, let's say, in Florida. In my class, I would probably have a class of 12 boys. I have three or four boys that are Sephardic, and you know, 8-9 boys that are Ashkenazic. But you know, I'm sure even in this room also. But there the breakdown was Spanish, Sephardic, and Ashkenazic. And Sephardic Jews are going to be exiled at the end of in 1492 and again 1497, and Ashkenazic Jewry also throughout since the Black Plague, since the mid 14th century, 1348 and on, it never was easy for the Ashkenazic Jews, but things towards the east, mainly Poland, started, opportunities opened up for the Jews. So when we come into the 15th century, we're going to find probably a majority of the Jews in the world are in countries that they were not 50 years earlier. Like that's why I think it's just very similar today, where all of us are taking what our you know, our parents and grandparents, whatever they took, whatever they had, where they were, they took with them to their new world, and that's what we have today. So if, I guess I wanted to focus first on the Spanish, because it, from Spain, in Spain, that was a more complete. In other words, when the, in 1492, when the Jews were kicked out of Spain, they were kicked out of Spain. There was no more practicing Jews in Spain, at least not openly practicing Jews, and many of them went to Portugal, and in 5 years later, they were no longer allowed to practice openly in Portugal as well. And then for the next 50 years or so, there was a steady stream of people getting out. But where did they go to? Many of them ended up either in the Ottoman Empire, or the Turks, or in Poland, which is east. So the world's going to move east. I figure before we start just with the Spanish, the Spanish exile, just a little bit maybe about the history of the Jews in Spain. A very, very brief, quick history. What did we have? So, really, again, the decree was in 1492, and there were many, many factors that led up to the expulsion of the Jews, and mainly when the Christians finally completed the reconquest of Spain in 1492, then they, once the Muslims were gone, then they decided to expel the Jews as well. If you just want just a very, very quick history of Spain, is before Spain was originally way, way back by the Visigoths, and they became Christian, and there were always Jews there. The Jews that were there were not they were not the scholarly Jews at the time. They were Jews all the way, you know, the center of learning, the center of Jewish life was Babel, was Babylonia. This is pre-7/11, Islamic takeover of the scene, of the world scene. So there were Jews under the Visigoths, and every so often the Visigoths, when they turned Christian, they every so often they said, okay, Jews have to be Christian. So the Jews then would like act like they're Christian for a few years or months or whatever, and then they would just go back to being Jews. They didn't really have the heart, you know, the will, the drive to make sure that the Jews always remain Christian. So I guess you could say, like, in Spain, going back hundreds of years, there was this like history of Jews acting like Christians just temporarily until the mood of the Christians would blow over. In the in the 600s, the 630s, this is a person by the name of Muhammad. He comes on the scene and he starts his own new religion. And within 100 years, 70 years, they sweep the boards. They take over everything. You can see over here. They start off in the Arabian Peninsula, and by the time Muhammad dies, they're just in the peninsula. And then there was about 3 or 4 caliphs, and they just sweep out. They take over. They go all the way to the east, into India, into China, and then they also start going into the West. And they start taking North Africa, and they eventually, after North Africa, they come up the Straits, what is that, the Gibraltar Straits, or they come up, and they come up into Spain. And they conquer pretty much all of Spain, and there's one last battle, the famous battle, Charles of Martel. This is it, the Battle of Tours is it. That was it. After that, there was nothing left. Had Charles Martel lost, that's it. This world would have looked a lot different, because Europe would have probably fallen also to the Muslims. But he held them on. And from that was in the year 711, Spain, Andalusia, the Peninsula of Andalusia, which was Spain was called back then, was all under the Muslims. They conquered pretty much the entire Spain, and that began what we would call the golden That's what we would call the golden era, golden age of Spain. From 7-11, the Muslims that took over were very moderate Arabs. They were looking for to be modern. They were looking for technology. They were looking for philosophy. They were it. This is the education. They wanted everything. They wanted, and when you're looking to become educated, you're looking for people that are smart. So the Jews were invited. And Jews were invited in, and they were treated very well. And one major advantage of having Jews is that the Jews never want to take over the country. You know, you invite other Muslims, so, you know, they may get to their head, hey, we could do better than you. But, you know, whatever country the Jews were in, they always knew the Jews are not taking over. But the Jews were very, very helpful in terms of building countries. That's what, I guess, for the next 1,000 years, the Jews were known to build your economy, to build the countries. They were middle class, and they would help with money lending, having capital available. We know even today that when there's money available and there's buildings, so building spurts jobs, and jobs spurts buying, you know, building more products, and that's how the economy expands. So the leaders realize this, and they realize that the Jews have this talent. It's probably more a God-given talent than anything else, that Hashem gave this bracha, that the Jews would be the ones, and therefore, to many of the leaders, I guess all throughout the next 1,000 years, the Jews were basically indispensable. They really needed the Jews. We'll see a few exceptions, and we're going to come to one right now. And there was always the other side was the church. And the church, they did not like the Jews. So the religious leaders, they were against the Jews, because the Jews stood against everything Christianity would stand for. And even in the Muslim world, depends on how fanatic the Muslims were. But the Jews were always caught in the middle, especially in the Christian world. In the Muslim world, as long as originally they tried to convert all the Jews, and when they realized that wasn't possible, so the Muslims became very pragmatic, and they realized, look, you know, as long as the Jews play the game, then they'll be fine. And the Jews knew how to play the game. You know, what were the Muslims asking? That Jews realized that, you know, you're only second fiddle. You have to realize that you're not number one. You're only, you know, if you could realize that we're better than you, then you'll get along, and overall it helped for the Jews, you know. The Jews were able to do that probably up until the modern age. You know, when the secular Jews came back to Palestine, and the Muslims expected the Jews to be, you know, like, just, you know, second fiddle, give us the hammer, we're better than you, and those Jews were not, so that caused issues and problems. And it was probably, you know, Once that was done, there was nothing. You couldn't put it back in the box, you know. All right, but that's what it was. So the Jews, as long as there was the Muslims held sway, and it was like for 200, 300, 400 years, the Muslims really pretty much had most of Spain, and the Jews did very, very well. Even since then, slowly but surely, the Christians kept winning back. And it wasn't a straight line up. You know, they would get a whole bunch, they'd lose a little bit for some time, they'd get more, they'd lose a little bit, they'd get more. And eventually, all of Spain came back to becoming the Christians. During that time, the Christians they needed the Jews. The Jews had a lot of advantages. They were allowed to do a lot of things there, more so than what was happening in the rest of Europe under the other Christians. And other Christians, the Jews, other Christian lands, the Jews were being not the word exiled, but they were being forced to leave their lands, and they were forced to wear certain clothing. But in Spain, the Jews were needed more. It was, I guess, more of a liberal attitude to the Jews in Spain, and therefore the Jews were able to have better positions and be able to do things a lot more. So this is basically, if you just from the 711 till the mid 1100s, it was basically Muslim, and the Christians started coming down as the Reconquest started coming in from the 11th century on. So things slowly but surely got worse for the Jews. Didn't get really worse until the end of the 1300s, 100 years before. This is a map of the year about mid-1100s. So you see already on the top, my pointer is not working, so I gotta get a new pointer. But over there, the brown is Portugal, then is Leon, Castile, up in the top is I think Valence, Navarre, and then, if I'm saying it right, and then Aragon is in the blue. And then a few more years later, they got a little bit more. This is about the year 1212. As you can see, they're conquering more. And comes by 1265, by the mid-1200s, this is what the map looked like. There was no more Leon. Leon and Castile combined. So you really had Castile, and the light blue is Aragon. Castile, Aragon, all the way at the end is Portugal, and then Navarre, if I'm saying it correctly, is all the way a small place on top, which ended, you know, also shortly after. Now, as long as the Muslims were still on the bottom, so they felt they needed the Jews. I guess there were wars that were necessary, and where do you get money from? You get it from the Jews. The Jews pay higher taxes, and the Jews help with the economy and collect the monies. And so the Jews always felt that they had there was a place for the Jews in Spain. That's what it was. And it was from 1265. So really, the status quo was like this from 1265 to 1492, which is over 200 years. This is the way it looked like. The Jews did not have it as well as they did under the Muslims, but they were still accepted, and they still had positions. They still their worst day in Spain was still better than the best day in Europe for a Jew in terms of the society around them. Jews were affluent. The Jews were also integrated into the society. Almost, if you really think about it, almost like, you know, the United States today as opposed to Israel. We'll see why, like, and what was the downfall. This also could have been the downfall of Spanish Jewry, as they started to get so into the society that when push came to shove, when there was a pogrom, and, you know, are you going to keep your faith or not, many lost it. Many gave it up. And that's going to be, we'll see soon what happened. Okay. Again, 1360, Granada's losing a little bit more, but Granada's still holding on. And again, Castile, Aragon. By the way, okay, and Aragon also had possessions. They had Majorca and all the places, even as far as Italy. The king of Aragon had holdings of land, even out in the sea. So it was very, very powerful countries or powerful areas. All right, 1391 is the beginning of the end of Spanish Jewry. 1391, there was a preacher, an archdeacon by the name of Ferrand Martinez, and he got up and he was just saying the most terrible, terrible things about the Jews. And he kept saying it, you know, I guess, you know, like Goebbels, just keep saying it till they believe it. Now, in 1390, the king of Castile, John I, died. And his son was only 11 years old at the time. So they had a regent for him, but he wasn't a strong king. At the same time, also, the archbishop died, and there was a vacuum in terms of leadership, which then there was really nobody to take care of the people, and the people just got out of hand. If they, you know, there's nobody running the show, nobody in charge. And in Seville, which is in the very, very south of Spain, there was a riot, and they went ahead and they killed many of the Jews there. Some have recorded that 4,000 Jews were killed, even though there were only about 450 to 500 families there. Some say it was as little as 800. But in any case, the Jews were either forced to either be killed or to convert. So afterwards, the people who led the riot, they first arrested them, but that just caused another backlash. And before you know it, this is in 1391, the riot started to spread to Cordova, Toledo, and this is all in Castile. And then eventually it went into the country of Aragon, Valencia, Majorca, Barcelona, Girona, Catalonia. So here, if it started all in Seville, here is Seville, and then it just started going. It's like the riots went from one place to another place to another place. And the Jews were given the choice of either being killed or converting. And this is, they say as many as, I think between 100,000 to 200,000 Jews converted. This was it. This was, when they talk about 100 or 200,000 Jews converting, I think they're really talking about from this moment on. This is, there were two times there were a lot of Jews were converting. But the mobs came. The mobs came into the houses with their guns or knives, and they gave them the choice: either be killed or convert. We would like to think, of course we would give our lives. It's very Baruch Hashem that we don't have these choices in our day. But many were given that choice, and many did not succeed. After about a year of this, finally, the kings got, even the king of Aragon also was a king. He was just more, had to solidify his power. But after a year of this, they got order back. And the kings were not so happy anymore because the rate that you tax a Jew was much higher than the rate that you tax a non-Jew. So the king lost a lot of money, at $100,000, 100,000 Jews taxing at at 10% as opposed to 40%. That's, So here's an example where the kings were interested in keeping Jews because they make more money than if they weren't. Order was restored in the 1390s afterwards. Those Jews that somehow remained, so they remained, but that was it. This is 1391, Jews are going to be thrown out in 1492. But the Jewish communities are now already a shadow of themselves. Now, of these, I guess what really would be very interesting is, interested to note is, these, let's say, 100,000 Jews or 200,000 Jews that converted. So what type of Christians were they? Were they really sincere? Did they see the light? So most of them, probably most of them just, they did it either at the time because they thought that they would be killed, or they thought that maybe, okay, we'll act in a few weeks, months, or whatever, they'll get tired of it, we'll go back to being Jewish. I would probably tend to imagine most of them were not really serious Christians. Plus, the Christians at the time, I remember reading up on this quite a bit. The Christians at the time, they didn't do good kiruv, So a guy wakes up the next morning, all right, he's Christian. All right, so what do I do now? So what did he do without thinking? He washes negel vasa and says modani. He puts his tefillin on. After he gets his tefillin on, his wife says, you're a Christian. He says, oh, you got your shakup? I forgot. Yeah, guys. He says, I forgot that I'm not Jewish anymore. They had no idea. They had no idea what to do when they woke up the next day. So, like, a lot of what they would have were doing was just out of habit, because that's what Jews were doing. You could have had, and so now, the Christians, on the other hand, at that moment, for the past 100 years, these Jews already were called new Christians, even as late as today. They are, I'm not so sure how today it works out, but for sure, through the mid-1800s, they were known as the old Christians and the new Christians. Who were the new Christians? These Jews. So even though officially at this point the church wanted them, no difference. See, the church themselves, once you're a Christian, you're a Christian, and they don't want to make that distinction. However, the people, they sort of made that distinction because of two reasons. First of all, like the lower Christian church, not the Pope and the higher up, but the lower down, they're seeing, hey, they're not acting like Christians. That's A. And B, once they're Christians, so now they can get full scholarships at all the colleges. You know, up until now, you're a Jew, there's only limited placements, you know, you have this course, this is more. Government positions, they were always overlooked for the raises, you know, the promotions were given to their own. And now all of a sudden, boom, they're Christians, and now everything is open to them. So the Hamonam, the general Christian population, was very jealous of this. They were upset. Who are these people? They're coming in, they're not serious, they're not, they don't know what they're doing, and then they're not up, they're taking our positions, they're taking our panasa. So the new Christians, they were from the outside, from the old Christians, they were called new Christians, and they were not trusted, and they were never, I wouldn't say never at all, I guess in certain areas it was a little better, different than others, but they were always called labeled as the new Christians. Also, it probably worked the Jews themselves. It was known when we read in the Chazal, the literature, the Shaila V'Tshuvas of the time, they say the Jews we know married into each other, and they were the Shaila V'Tshuvas. See if we get to them. Later at the time when they started coming out, do we view them as Jews? Do we view them as Christians? Could you marry into them? Could you not marry into them? Like, well, what's their status? So, you know, they said it was known, Dover Yadua, that the Jews, the new Christians, they would usually marry among themselves. And it probably was right. The Jews themselves, most of them were not sincere. You know, they were very, you know, they just did it because they didn't want to die at the time. And you know, they got stuck. But among the Christians, once you go, you can never come back. So the Spanish Inquisition is not going to be coming to Spain till the to the 1480s. So 1390, you're going to have 100 years of Jews that are like sort of in the middle, and then it could very well have been where they caught some of a family. So in the family, you could have some of the kids are Christians and some of the kids are Jews. What do you do at the Pesach Seder, you know? Do you bring in eggs for the Easter thing? Or do you bring in matzahs? You know, what do you do? And I guess we'll see, the Christians were also concerned about that. They, in a certain way, they felt that the remaining Jews were bad hashpa on the new Christians, because they're, you know, they can get them whatever they wanted, you know, they can get them the Sfarim and Sidurim and tell them what the holidays are. And so it was, that was also part of what it was. Okay, so after a year, this was the beginning of the end. The Jewish community was a shadow of itself. Then something came up in 1413. In 1413, I'm not sure this is, the Pope. They had a different set of popes in France. I'm not sure if this had to do with that, which I believe it did. But there was a big disputation. There was a debate between the Jews and the non-Jews. Now they learned their lesson from the Ramban. When the Ramban had his debate in 1260, and the Ramban wiped the floor with whoever he was going up against, but that was a fair debate. You know, the Ramban was able to say his thing, and the other person was able to say their thing, and you know, the king at the end of the debate, they ended it after a week because they realized things were not going the way they hoped it was going. And the king said about the Ramban, he never, the quote was something like, I never saw anybody defend something so wrong so well. I mean, that's how the king Jaime. Huh?
King Jaime.
It was King Charles, no?
No, King James.
James, it was King
Jaime
James.
Jaime in Spanish.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Okay, it was King James. That was King James. So there it comes in 1413. They wanted to have another debate, and it was more like a, I guess you could say like a pageant. It was a show. At some point, they had a big, magnificent building, and they had like you could have like 2,000 spectators, the popes and big Christians, and the Jews were sent in there, and they were like, you know, very, you know, just already intimidated just by everything around them, plus the fact that when the Christians quoted different sources, the Jews were not able to see where the quotes came from. So you're quoting things. I don't know what are you quoting? Where are you getting this from? You know, like, no, we're not telling you. Plus the fact that they didn't even let them go to their quarters and go ahead and just prepare. You know, they were bothered by there, and it was this for the Jews. This was a tremendous debacle. It was, I think, one of the lead rabbis converted. One of he converted, some others converted, but at the end, the I think it was Rabbi Rav Albo, and he wrote the sefer. We have it today. I just saw it. I forgot where I saw. I don't know if I saw it in Hollywood in the Kollel, but I saw it. The sefer Ikrim was put up by Rav Albo in response. I don't know if in response to this or after this, and basically, at the end of the debate, the answers that were given to the Christians were so clear, and you know, like, you know, it wasn't, the debate was not recorded well like it was by the Ramban. The Ramban himself wrote out, it's called Bikurach HaRamban. We have that recorded, the responses back and forth, but this we don't have as much. The debate took a year and a half, and they took all the rabbis from all over and they put them in one place, and they couldn't be back. They were forced to be there. At some point, all the rabbis said, "We're not talking." That's how it sort of ended. The rabbis just, we're not debating. We want to go home. They weren't letting them. They were keeping them there. But it was very, very disheartening.
The point is that these latter debates after Ramban, the church had learned its lesson, and they rigged the rules.
Right.
So they could not insult the church.
Correct.
Right.
Good point. I'm just saying it for here. But one of the things was is that the Ramban asked the king, King James, "Can I defend Judaism? Or can I say something against Christianity?" And the King James said yes. Now, and he did, and he was able to show how Christianity was flawed, and it got him in trouble because he went that Shabbos. He was in Barcelona, so he got up in the shul and he told the Jewish community there what he said, what they said, back and forth. Now, the priests that were there afterwards wanted the Ramban to be killed. And they went to the king and said, "They have to kill the Ramban." Why? Because he said over what was in the debate, including he said things against the church, which he's not allowed. They said, but, you know, so the Ramban said, "What do you mean? I just repeated what was in the debate." And they said, "No, that you only had permission during the debate to talk against the Christian church." So the pshara was that the Ramban was thrown out of Spain. He was told he had to leave, couldn't come back. So where did the Ramban go? He went to Eretz Yisrael. Came to Yerushalayim at the time, 1260s, and with the Crusades, the Jewish community, there was no Jewish community in Yerushalayim at the time, with the fighting back and forth. And basically he found 2-3 Jews. He got some Jews from Gaza, from Shechem, where else? And then he put together a minyan. He found an old building, and he started what was the Ramban shul today. You can go to the place where there's a Ramban shul. It's not the same shul, because in 1948, it was the same shul until 1948. 1948, the Arabs came and destroyed everything. So, yeah, but in 1967, when we got the old city back, I don't know if it's the same place or similar, but they either refurbished the old Ramban shul or started a Ramban shul nearby. So today the Ramban, but since the Ramban, there had always been a Jewish community, a minyan of Jews in Yerushalayim. You know, and from 48 to 67, it was outside the old city, but there was always since then, since the Ramban in 1267, I think it was, so he had was able to have a fair. Now, when it came to the future debates, including this one, the Jews could not insult the church. You only have a right to prove that Judaism, you know, you have to defend Judaism, but you can't go on the offense and show how Christianity is fake. And it was terrible for the Jews. Many converted, and there was also another wave of conversions in between 1413 and 1415. So in 1391, about 15 years later, another wave. So at the end of this wave, in 1414, 1415, this was, I guess, the hardest time for the Jews. But by 1420, the Jewish community got like a hold of itself, and they strengthened itself. One of the things that the Jews did is they moved from the big towns to small areas. But they were nowhere near the influence that they had as from Jews to what they were now. You still had, but nothing. The numbers of the community was a shadow of itself. You also had now, from this moment on, Jews are leaving Spain. You know, the numbers are leaving as opposed to coming, because it's not hospitable anymore to Jews. So people that, you know, they're not doing well over there. So you have starting also the people are leaving Spain. Okay, so but this is what was from 1420 until the end. For the next 70 years, you had the small amount of Jews that are Jews, and but you also have a large Anusim community. They were called Maranos. Marano means pig. So why were they called Maranos? Why were they called pigs? Either because to show that they were Christians, they'd eat pig in public. Or just like pig, you're a pig. You know, you're not really honest. You're not really true to being Christian. You're like dirty like a pig. Or what does a pig do? It shows its hooves, like it's kosher or not kosher. Yeah. It's like it's kosher. So you're just in public showing yourself like a Christian. Let's just move forward in history towards the very very end. The Abarbanel, there's really is a lot to say about the Abarbanel. The Abarbanel was originally his family was in Portugal, but there was a change of kings in Portugal, and his life was threatened. They were killing all those that were loyal to the other king, so the Abarbanel was tipped off that he better run for his life, don't just leave, and he did. He left from Portugal, he went to Spain, and he was picked up by Fernandez as to be his finance minister. Again, this is during this time, war, they still had the wars against the Muslims in the south, and he was the finance minister. He got the country in order in terms of the finance. He it was, I guess, due to the Abarbanel that the Muslims lost, and that the Spain is going to expel the Jews. Just a little bit. Maybe I really should just go back a bit. Like we mentioned before, Castile and Aragon, those were the two big parts of Spain, each one like its own country, ruled by its own ruler. King Fernandez was, they made a shidduch between him and Queen Isabella. And when that happened, Castile and Aragon became one big country. And now, as one big country, they were able to better fight the Muslims. And Spain was pretty much one big country, one that entire peninsula was now under one monarch, with the exception, of course, of Portugal and Navarre in the north, and when they got the Muslims out in the south, so it was all one big country. Now, once they had, it was no longer no Muslims at all, they figured they didn't need their Jews. So in the palace of Alhambra Palace in Granada, this used to be the base, this was the area where the Muslims lived, that was their big, government, a city, palace. And from this area is where Fernadette and Isabel, and they signed it on March 31st, and they said the Jews have 3 months to get out of town, get out of Dodge or whatever. That's it, they all had to leave. They had 3 months. And it was terrible for the Jews. I mean, you just imagine, again, in 1492, the Jews really came in mass in 711. So the Jews were in this country for 700 years. And they were tied up in this country, and they made this country. And this country was their own, and they loved this country. It was, you know, they contributed so much to the country, and it was just, you know, it was very, very, you know, hard, you know, for the Jews to accept, and it was a big shock to everybody. This is what the Alhambra decree, if anybody reads Spanish or whatever, it's okay. Okay, so now when they decided to get rid of their Jews, so there was like the real reason and the party line reason. Like, you know, why are you getting rid of your Jews? So the justification, what was said at the press conferences was that we're getting rid of the Jews because the Jews are a bad hashpa on the new Christians. Okay? The new Christians are being influenced. They see Jews around and they ask them shilas, and we can't keep that. They try as much as they could to separate the Jews from the new Christians, but it's very difficult to. It was an open, free society. People can go, you know, go wherever they want, and they felt that a lot of the backsliding of the new Christians were because of the Jews. They see Jews and they're backsliding. So we have to get rid of the Jews for that reason. They would supply them with like matzah, circumcision, prayer books. Okay, that was their justification. The real reason was really money. I mean, you know, most of it was. I mean, there was a law in the books, which I guess we'll see, is that the Jews can't take their money with them. They money, as a matter of fact, since 1480, for 10, 15 years already, nobody was allowed to take money out of Spain. So what do you do with your money? You'd have to buy objects. And then, you know, with those objects that you'd buy, then you could take out, at least legally. Which is very, very interesting, because when about half the Jews went to Portugal, and the king of Portugal only allowed Jews to come in for a few months, provided that they pay money. So they had to bring money in to pay off the king of Portugal, but they weren't allowed to take money out of Spain. So how they did this, okay, but that's what they did. Okay, so it is said that Abarbanel went to the king of Spain, Fernadette, who loved money. This is, you know, he was always in need of money, and he said to him, he says, look, I'll give you all my money, just let the Jews stay. And it was, you know, he was working on the king, and the king would have let it done, go through. However, Tocamanda, who was the confessor to Isabel, who was, I think his father was like a new Christian. I think his father had converted. But Tocamanda, he believed it. I mean, he was like the real deal. I mean, he wasn't in it for the money. He was in it because he believed it. And he came in at the time, he says, the Jews sold Yashka for $30. I don't know what he's referring to, for 30, and you're going to do it him again? So sell him. And he came in just at that time, and Isabel said, forget it, deal's off, we're not selling Jews, Jews got to go. So at that point, the Jews realized they have to go. Again, you have 3 months to sell all your stuff and go. You know, into items. You could basically, so what do you do with your house? What do you do with your car?
Fire sale.
Basically, So it brings down when, you know, the people writing at the time, they said they would sell a house for like a donkey, you know, just to put your stuff on to travel with your donkey. I mean, that's basically, it was a fire sale. People knew, why am I going to pay you top dollar for your house? You're leaving anyway. I'm just going to walk in and take it. You know, almost like what happened in Poland. You know, they say that the Jews were taken out of the houses. The food was still hot on the stove, and the guy came in and they just, you know, ate breakfast from the food that was there. I mean, that's basically what happened here. I don't know if it's to the credit of the Christians, but the Spanish, they didn't kill the Jews on the way out, but the Jews were just, you know, told to walk, and they were told to go. All right. This is a priest. So we have like a diary or a Catholic priest, Andres Bernaldez. And he writes, this is what he writes, what he saw, eyewitnessing the accounts. Rich Jews paid the expenses of the departure of the poor, practicing towards each other the greatest charity. They wouldn't become converts. In the first weeks of July, they took the routes for, they took the route quitting the native land, great and small, old and young. They had great trouble, some falling, other rising. This is like, I've seen this in, wherever you go, you see this paragraph. Illness, but this is, and this is very interesting, and this is where I was really like looking around and reading. It says, he writes, but those who converted were very few. In 1492, when the Jews were sent to leave, very few converted. When you hear, and like you'll read some of the historians that they read about the day, they say, well, from the 500,000 Jews, 200,000 converted. So from our sources, very, very, very few of the Jews converted. But from the past 100 years, there were Jews that were already converted. From like I mentioned in 1390s, in the 1410 to 1413, the Jews at that point were converted. And there may have been about 200,000 Jews for 100 years from that community. But it's brought down by our sources. The Abarbanel himself writes in the beginning of Malachim, in the Hakdama, he writes about the tragedy of him leaving and everything. But and most of them, most of the people say that the Jews at that point, very, very few converted. Very few converted. So that's it. They all left. How many left? How many left? I saw as little as 100,000 to as many as 300,000. So, and the question is where'd they go, and did they all make it there? The Jews now, the problems of the Jews leaving are first starting. It's not like they left, they got on a plane, and they came to Turkey, and there were people waiting with them for with open arms, and the Federation over there, you know, went ahead and put them at, you know, like low-income housing, and they had to work their way up. The issues from the Jews are first starting. And that's a little bit, I don't know, we'll see if we get to a little bit now, but this is what's going to be their story. And this is the tragedy that's going to happen. And okay, so just going on, just also very interesting, I guess this is one of these quirks of history. You see how, you know, again, I guess you could say how Hashem is like running the world, the ironies, or Hashem's sense of humor, however you want to say it, is that there was a discoverer, explorer by the name of Christopher Columbus. He was Italian in origin, and he was trying to get, for many months, he was trying to get the Fernandad and Isabel to sponsor his trip to the New World. Again, he believed that he could reach the West Indies by traveling around the world, you know, the other way. And he was right, except he didn't realize that America was in the way. So that's why he called right the Indies, the West Indies. He actually believed at first that he was in India. His support came from conversos, anusim. I mean, that's who were those that made the connections between him and the and the royal crown. That's the it, so therefore, because of that, it's really it's really logical to believe it's very, very possible that Christopher Columbus was a converso. He was a Jew. Because his friends were, that's with the circles that he hung out with. That's the circles that who sponsored him. His interpreter, he needed an interpreter who knew a lot of languages. His interpreter was a Jew that had just recently converted. Maybe he was one of the few that converted, like, or either for the voyage or around that time. He was the first person on the New World. So if you want to just say, like, you know, the first person who got off the boat from Christopher Columbus and got onto the New World was for sure a Yid.
The Jews are always getting off the
boat. Yeah, they're getting off. Just got there a little early, whatever. Okay, in any case, but so why am I bringing in Christopher Columbus now is because he was supposed to leave August 1st. And he writes in his diary that there was so much traffic in the harbor because the Jews were, any boat that they can get a hold of, they were trying to get out, that he had such traffic he couldn't get out of the harbor. So I don't know if it took him a long time to get out of the harbor or he just waited another day to start to leave. And that's what he writes in his diary, that he couldn't leave because of this. He ended up discovering, I guess, like the New World, where today, or over 400 years later, almost 500 years later, America, the land that he discovered, is going to be the place of refuge for the Jews, much later on in history. So it was Spain itself. The day that they're kicking out the Jews is the day that America is going to be discovered to save Jews later on. All right, take whatever you can, whatever you want to make of that. That I guess you could. These are just about the four or five trips that he made into North America. Okay, 5 more minutes. Also, Rabbi Yosef Yaivitz, who was also an eyewitness, he writes, many of the Jews left Spain were really the humble folk, simple faith, untainted by philosophical musings, a large number with women. He felt that the women had more faith than the men overall. Great rabbis, and he speaks about the Don Isaac Abarbanel. And he was the hero of the Jews of the day. He had it to such a point, he was so needed. Ferdinand felt he was so needed. He said to Abarbanel, "What will it take you to stay? You don't have to convert. What will it take you to stay?" So he says, "Look, I need a minion." So the Ferdinand said, "You got a minion. I'll let you keep 10 Jews here that don't have to convert. What else do you need?" In other words, he felt that he was so indispensable with his being finance minister and helping Spain that he was willing to give the Abarbanel anything that he wanted. And to the Abarbanel's credit, to this day, Abarbanel is like a hero among the Jewish people. The fact that he could have stayed and he gave it all up for the Jewish people. He ended up in Naples, in Italy, became the king of Naples, then, asked for his advice, and the king of Naples had to go into exile, and Abarbanel went with him into exile. But the Abarbanel, he was... His Sfarim on Tanakh is still used today. This is the same Abarbanel. Gave it all up for the Jewish people, and it was a tremendous chizik for the Jewish people. They saw their greatest rabbi willing to go and give it up, and it was a chizik for them as well. As he says, it left behind his entire fortune. Just an idea, when the King of Aragon said that I'm kicking out all the Jews, it wasn't only in Spain. It was in all of his holdings also. It was Majorca, Sardinia, and Sicily. I don't know if this is in 1400, this map. I don't know how much of Naples he had. But he definitely had holdings outside. And after they kicked out the Jews in Spain itself, then they started kicking out the Jews in his other areas. So Jews and these other things were given time. That's it. You got to leave. Only Christians here. I guess I'm just trying to figure, maybe we should end it here. But really, we're up to the trip, I guess. And I guess maybe we'll just focus in on this, and Mr. Shem next week, just focus in on the trip, certain things that happen on the trip. And if you read what the writers were happening to the Jews from Spain to where they had to go to, and then you read the Tochacha in the Torah, which says what's going to happen if the people don't do what they're supposed to do, it's very scary how very, very things are similar and things that overlap. All right, any questions? Yes, Jerry.
Did any of those Jews leave with Christopher Columbus on one of his three ships?
So there's a lot, you know. Do they really know? They don't know. Like I told you, his interpreter was, but they say very, very many of them were. Yes?
They say his map maker was also.
Okay. Well, I hope to get into that, because map makers were exclusively Jews in those days. In those days, map makers were, that's it, they had the monopoly on maps. We're all Jews. I mean, part of it was is because you could, you know, Chaim over here could call up Beryl in this country, and they were much more well connected than, you know, Christians and Muslims and different Protestants and Catholics, and so they were able to. But yeah, the map making was. And also Jacob's staff and instruments used to measure where you are and how far, that's all were the Jewish inventions. This is all came from. So, Mr. Shem, I do hope to go a little bit when we speak about Portugal into the a little bit about how the Jews and exploration, they were really, it almost could not have been done without the Jews. All right, so thank you all for coming. And Mimir Tashem, next week we'll just go on, continue.